Cue Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 282nd episode of Weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 281 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. But once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. We have some great guests continue to be lined up beginning tonight. I hope you'll all join me next week at the same time for an interview with poet, writer, and teacher Christina Orleani. Before getting into tonight's conversation, some local Hudson Valley news. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday night is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 22nd year, at 6:30 p.m. in the Mahopac Library on 6 in Mahopac. Where else? More than 170 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also has the morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So July's meeting will be on Wednesday, July 17th at 10 a.m. at coffee time on Route 6 and in the Red Mill section of Mahopac. There are also two poetry workshops in the area, one in Mahopac and one in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of the month at the Mahopac Library at 6:30, and the Yorktown one is on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hart Library in Triple Oak. In July, the Mahopac one will be next Wednesday, July 10th, and the Yorktown one on July 23rd. Finally, the next open mic at the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center in the Philipsey Mount train station in Sleepy Hollow will be on Friday, July 19th at 7 p.m. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. Now to this week's show. As mentioned, it's 182nd in the series. Tonight I'm joined by novelist and managing director of the wonderful and aforementioned Hudson Valley Writers Center in Sleepy Hollow, Krista Madsen. I first met Krista, at, as one might expect, at the Hudson Valley Writers Center. The listeners wishing to join Chris and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Good evening, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Happy to be number 282.
Where exactly did you grow up and go to early school?
So I'm from Bristol, Connecticut, which is kind of in the middle, closer to Hartford. And I went to public schools all the way through, and then college. I didn't go that far, but it felt like another planet to go to Yale, which I'm very grateful for. And then I went. I got my MFA in creative writing at the New School.
You're way ahead of me. I'm back on your grammar school.
Oh, sorry. Just grammar school.
My wife who grew up in
Connecticut public school.
My wife who grew up in the Philadelphia area, always told me that the Bristol stomp originated down there. Did the people in Bristol, Connecticut, think the Bristol stomp came from Bristol, Connecticut?
That's a good thing to know. We know it never came up, but I know there's Bristol, England, and they're kind of our sister city from afar, because one time I called the mayor in the middle of the night as a reporter. So I don't know. I'll have to ask Bristol, England. I think it's not us.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
I always wanted to be, I never got very far through the alphabet. I wanted to be things that began with the letter A, which was probably an accident, but I wanted to be an artist, an architect, an astronaut, and an author. So I wasn't totally wrong. I didn't get to be an astronaut, but I did always know that I was going to be a writer. So it could have been a very different life that I didn't take.
Were you an early reader?
Yes, very much. I had a kind of crazy, chaotic household with a lot of, and I wouldn't say a lot, normal-sized household with four people, but all very eccentric and very literary, probably in more practical ways. My dad was a scientist, but there were lots of books on shelves, and it was a very loud household, so I would just try to find a nook, and maybe it was my escape to read a lot. I just remember that since my brother was 4 years older than me, he was kind of doing his own thing, and I remember being alone so much and reading, because of course people didn't really have parents parenting back then anyway. You just kind of did your own thing.
And then what about your high school? You mentioned that you stayed in public school system in Bristol?
Yes. So I was at Bristol Eastern High School. There's also a Bristol Central, but those are the two public schools. I played tennis, and that was kind of my only real sport in my life. And I was just very academically, I wouldn't say I was gifted. I just worked really hard. I don't know. In retrospect, I probably didn't learn as much as I should have, because I was one of those people trying to get all A's and do really good. Perfectionist.
Did you write for a school paper or a literary journal while you were in high school?
Yeah, I actually wrote for my hometown newspaper, so I kind of jumped ahead and didn't do that much. I did do stuff in the high school. There wasn't that much, but we had a little thing. But I started being, I forget what they called it, a Bristol Press Explorer, where I was on the Explorer post, where there were some high school kids who were thrown into full-on journalism, where you're just sent out to write articles that would actually get into the paper. So that was pretty cool.
Did they pay you, or was it just publication?
Then I wasn't getting paid, but as soon as I graduated, I actually started working for the paper and did that through college. Whenever I came home for breaks, I would still write for the Bristol Press.
Terrific. And what happened after high school? You mentioned you went to Yale.
Yeah, sorry, I jump ahead because I'm not good at chronology, so I have no sense of keeping my grammar school separate from my college. I feel like a child all the way through my life. But yes, I went to Yale. I was an English major, and I guess the journalism thread really runs through a lot of my life, even though I don't think of myself as a journalist. I've always been a fiction writer in my mind, but I am actually writing facts in journalism sometimes. But I worked in college. You didn't get paid again, but it was volunteering for the Yale Daily News, which was incredible.
My oldest friend, Kevin Buckley, who was later the news reporter in Vietnam during the war, was the editor of the Yale Daily News, and he was the first Buckley since William F. Buckley, no relation, to
mm-hmm.
hold that position. So.
Okay. I was going to say there's quite a Buckley legacy there, so that's interesting that they're not related. It was, incredible to be putting out a daily newspaper when you already have a lot of other things going on in college. We were there every night for 5 hours a night or more, insane. And then it would, actually go to press like 1 or 2 a.m.
Now, were you a reporter or did you write featured sometimes? Or what exactly did you write for the paper?
They start you off as when you're a sophomore, you're a contributor, and you can kind of choose your beat and go down whatever path. And then the thinking is that you'll grow into becoming on the editorial board the following year. I think I was just a junior when you become an editor, and that's really when it becomes your job. And before that, you're just dabbling in writing whatever you feel like. But I became a features editor, which I thought, I'm always trying to take a more creative approach, and I'm not usually interested in hard news. So I wanted to write more, interviews with people doing interesting things like you.
And what did you do after college?
Oh gosh, so many things, but I would say that, again, it's always been very, liberating for me to know that I'm a writer no matter what, and it gives me clarity, but it also gives me a great excuse to do whatever the heck I want in any different direction imaginable, because then I could just always say I was always planning on writing about it afterwards or during. Right after college, I went off, much to my parents' chagrin, I went off and became a nanny, just based on this handwritten postcard I saw at it's called Yale Station, which is the Yale post office, and had all the P.O. boxes. And there was just a little sign before I graduated. And I was kind of upset that a lot of people I saw who claimed and behaved like they were going to become artists and poets were wearing a lot of suits lately. And they were all doing job interviews on campus or getting shipped off here and there to meet banks in the city. And I was freaking out about all that. And I thought everybody was going to be gone and become a lawyer or a banker. And then I saw that handwritten postcard to become a nanny in Brussels for a French-speaking family for this little 3-year-old boy. Yeah, so I was just like, okay. And I didn't even talk directly to the family. They had a friend who was an instructor on campus. So I met with him. And then I just bought my plane ticket. It was so weird because it wasn't all the email and everything. It was only just beginning.
No, that's good. Did you speak French?
No, that was the scariest part. And I thought, oh, what a great opportunity. I'll go finally learn a language because I've always been pretty terrible at languages. And, even the requirements in college didn't get me very far. I studied Latin in high school and 1 year of German in college. So I couldn't actually talk to anybody in Latin, of course, and very little in German. So I thought, oh, I'll go live with this family and I'll have this cosmopolitan French experience, but it's Belgium, which is very different. And everybody there is from somewhere else because it was the head of the EU. And this family had no interest in me speaking my beginner French to their young boy who was also learning French, and they didn't want me to mess him up. They only wanted me to teach him English. So they were very strict about, like, don't utter a word of French. And it was such a trip because it got to the point where I was dreaming in French, and I wanted to speak it, but I had to translate back into English to get the words out. So I started talking in a very French way, like, it is good, the bread, no? And so I was still messing up his English with my Frenchified English, no matter what.
So how long were you there?
I was only supposed to stay a year. I ended up staying a year and a half because I ended up getting this Scottish boyfriend who was a manager of a bar, and all these expats were at this bar. It was just a very creative, weird kind of place, full of characters, right off the Grand Place in the center of town. And I stayed on a little longer with him, and then I realized, yeah, like, kind of enough already. Like, I guess I have to go begin my life. And I knew I was going to come home and go to New York City and try to be a writer. So I think I was scared and putting it off a little bit, but it was inevitable that I was going to come home. And I got to travel, so you can't say no to some traveling on the side.
And then when you came back to New York, what did you do then?
I was at my parents' house again in Bristol and was taking the bus into the city to do some interviews of whatever, because it was really my first job, so I didn't get the pick of the world. But I just kind of took the first thing that I got because it was winter when I got back, and it was snowing, and these bus trips were pretty horrifically nerve-wracking because I had to get to job interviews, and I knew I had to get there on time, but it depended on, you know, bus traffic in the snow for 2 hours. So I just took whatever job. I ended up working in advertising. I would have preferred it if I was on the creative side. I was on the account side, which was more technical, and you had to wear a suit and have meetings and do spreadsheets. But what I loved about it was, well, it was super weird because it was the center of the world. It was Times Square. And what was great about it was I get to go to everything. It was a great introduction to the city, access to things I couldn't otherwise afford because I got free tickets to everything. And I always got to go to Broadway shows, and I got to go to cocktail parties. So that aspect was fun. The job itself was pretty stupid. But I was actually advertising for book publishers. So you could feel good about that, at least, that we weren't selling something silly.
Now, at some point, you also got into the bar business. How did that happen?
Another journey off path, I guess, but I always felt like I was right on track. But after various jobs in New York, I always lived in the city until recently. I did editorial work and was an editorial manager of a website that wrote book reviews. And eventually I started applying to grad school. I went to grad school. And as soon as I was in that grad school mode, I just kind of dropped off normal work life and started having a more part-time kind of artistic bohemian life with, you know, one of my part-time jobs was helping people paint pottery in one of those paint-a-pot shops. And I just developed the best set of friends that I still will have forever in that shop of all these people who, of course, did other things. Like, they were trying to be actors or they were writers. So I just had this really strong group of friends. And through the MFA program, I had a really good base now of writer people. And eventually I moved to Brooklyn, I think 2004. And I just kind of lived in this neighborhood. I like to hunker down and live very locally and create kind of a little neighborhood for myself. And I realized I would have to kind of create more of my own community if I wanted it. And it was back when Williamsburg, of course, was coming up, but it wasn't like fully exploded. But I would jog, and I would jog around the neighborhood, and I just always had, I was always interested in storefronts and looking at spaces. And just one day I found this place and I thought, I wanted to open a place, which would be the place that I would want to go, but didn't quite exist yet where I was. And I envisioned it as an arts lounge. Even though technically it earned money as a bar, I always called it an arts lounge. The name of it was Stain, and it was called, the theme was Make Your Market Stain Bar. And it was really a community space I created where on East Williamsburg, back when, I would have been a pioneer there because I was the only girl on the block doing such a thing in between a dollar store and a bodega. And it was very brave and it was very exciting and it was really hard.
That's interesting because some of the bigger successes for my old neighborhood in New York own bars on their way to books, movie deals, and high-ranking State Department positions. One of them was on the Benghazi committee, and another one has a book about delivering beer to people from the neighborhood in Vietnam that's being made into the movie by the Green Book last year. And so it's very interesting that you established the relationship with people. Now, you mentioned going to grad school in 2004, but you already had the book publishing in 2003, didn't you?
So the time, I think it was in grad school from 2000 to 2002, and it was pretty cool when I was graduating because I already knew an older book I had written was going to be getting published. So before I even graduated, I knew that was coming, and I knew he was actually going to take both my old books. So I wrote one of them that I finished when I was in grad school, and I had another one in my pocket that was kind of more about my time in Belgium. So they were both coming out.
Tell us about the first book, and then we'll get on to Four Corners. Tell us about the first one published.
Yeah, it seems like a million years away from me, and I laugh a little bit about it because it was the first book, so I want everybody to cut it some slack. But, when you're writing about the things that are most important to you at the time, always. So I was compelled then to write it. So I try not to cringe when I read it, but when I read it, I feel like it's a different person, a different time. So I can read it with such distance, it doesn't even feel like me. So I think I could have perspective on it now. But it's called Degas Must Have Loved a Dancer. And it's not at all about the painter Degas. It's just inspired by that idea that in order to paint something so much, you must be very propelled by something. So it's kind of about how desire could drive the telling. And the idea is there's two people, and this is fiction, this wasn't based on any real experience I had in Belgium, but the setting is accurate and some of the characters are, but the rest is projected into fiction, that this woman traveling, she's an expat, she sees this guy from a distance when she's traveling, and she just kind of imposes on him this whole fantasy about how great they would be together as artists, but she also decides that it would be really great kind of never to actualize that, and it would just be way better for her as a writer to keep it at bay. And much to the destruction of everybody. So I guess the premise is like, can you propel a story that will never come to consummation? Like it'll, quite literally, I guess, and metaphorically, like you'll never get there. So is it worth the ride? So I was kind of playing with a lot of metaphor in that and questioning what the impulse of art is about and how do you tap into that. And I was taking notes for this book the whole time I was in Europe, just observational kind of notes of this and that, and then I went home and kind of got this out, nights and weekends during my first few jobs in the city.
You mentioned that it seemed like a different person then, and it's and the moved on from it, but there were great reviews for it on Amazon. One person compared your writing to Flambeau. That must have been very heady with your first
book.
Yeah,
it's really nice. Yeah, I mean, it didn't have, it's a small press, it had a very small life, and I'm I love the writing. I'm not as good at selling it, and obviously I'm not good talking it up, but I'm amazed because it's mine, and I think, oh, well, it's a good first start. I've always thought I'll write many more books after that, so I've never been all that attached to how precious it is. But it's really cool, and when people appreciate my intent, and sometimes they totally mistreat, like this lady, I don't know if you noticed on Amazon, she was really mad because she expected to get a book so she could write her thesis on Degas, the artist.
I did read that,
well, did you not notice that it said fiction and it had a little blurb about this couple in love? So nothing to do with the painter.
2 years
but
later, in
2005,
you're back with Four Corners. Please tell us about that one.
Yeah, this is one that does feel closer to more of the writer I am now. Of course, hopefully I've progressed since then as well, but all my writing begins from my life and then goes elsewhere pretty dramatically. I'm pretty over the top. I like to exaggerate things. I guess you can call some aspects of it magic realism or American Gothic or whatever you want to say. My writing can be very dark and very poetic, but I definitely take the pieces of reality that I know and just extend them beyond. It's somewhat based on my family dynamic growing up, but instead of the father being larger than life, he really is too big. Like he's taller than the ceiling, so he's always kind of crouched over. So when I see movies that play with that, like being John Malkovich and that kind of stuff, I always think they, you know, I wrote it first, but I love those kind of odd scenes and odd characters and big visuals with quirky people. So it's very much just a family of four, and it's called Four Corners, so I'm very visual. The first book has a lot of visual art in it because there's an artist in it, a visual artist. And in the second one, my idea of Four Corners is that the themes are always set in a square. So there's always this symmetry, and they're either at a square table or the four posters of the bed, which I guess is more of a rectangle, but whatever. But there's four people in the family, and it's all about that dynamic between that and kind of the mythology of growing up and how flawed memory can be and all you impose on the story of your youth. And maybe it's not that true. Maybe it's more of a legend. And you realize as the story progresses that maybe she's not as honest as she makes it out to be, and she's exaggerated things. So I'm, again, playing with the writer is in the book, kind of writing the story as you read it.
Well, both of these got good reviews. Why Nothing Since?
Life happened to me, but I have, you know, I opened the bar 2004 to 2009, and when I was basically living in the bar full time, because I was a one-woman show there, I was also the bartender and the manager, and it was really overwhelming. I did finish a book that I had been working on during that time, and I was sending it out a little bit, but I never really had the time to fully deal with the work of submitting a thing. And so it's unfortunate because the little window of me being interested in the book kind of passed. I think too much time went by, and now I can't figure out how to access wherever that was. But in the meantime, the whole time I was owning the bar, I wanted to write a bar novel. And ever since then, that's been kicking around in my brain, and I write a little bit here and there. But I had kids, and I, you know, real life. I'm now a big girl with little people, so I don't know how people do it, to be honest. I'd like to hear from moms about how they make that work, because I'm not that kind of writer. I've always had to completely drop out of life and be really extreme about it. Like, I become a hermit, I quit my job, I spend 6 months hold up and I produce a book. And life since children and practical, you know, needs of paying the bills and everything. I have a mortgage. I'm a single mom now. I haven't been able to figure out how to just dabble in writing a novel. I could probably write poetry more successfully, but I'm not as interested. So
I remember years ago I interviewed for a newspaper series. I was involved in Mary Higgins Clark, and she had been after high school, and she had written for a high school paper. She had gone to become a stewardess, and she got married, and she had either four or five kids. Then her husband died, and she began to write for these radio bits they used to have, the greengrocer and things like this. And then she wrote a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt just to prove that she could do this. And then she wrote her first mystery, and it became the big success, Where Are the Children? And then she wound up with that money, with the advance from the new one, moving into Manhattan with the kids, going to Fordham downtown in philosophy. And she would get up at 6 every morning, and she'd write until lunch. And then she'd either go off to lunch, and that would be the end of it, or after lunch, she keep writing again. And she felt it was only this routine was the only way that she could do this, you know. So even when she was pushing books on tour and everything, then she wouldn't be writing. But when she was writing, it was every day the same thing. And I remember reading that Stephen King used to tell people that he wrote 2,500 words every day other than his birthday and Christmas. He said later that he was just trying to say that you have to be in a regiment, you know. So it's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's
in
very
Hemingway,
difficult.
Of course.
Yeah, to put it all together. My wife and I taught at the computer center in the New School years ago, and that was the New School, and that whole area is a very interesting area in New York City. So
we really liked it.
Well, so you're now the managing director of the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center in Sleepy Hollow, New York. But I always begin with the wonderful when referring to it. And I had its founder, Margaret Taft Steve, on the show not long ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great story of the beginnings. How long have you been there, and what exactly are your duties?
So I started June 2017, and we can blame my day job now for why I'm not more of a creative writer, even as the person who basically runs a writer's center. No time to write, but I get to write a lot of grants. So I'm writing all the time. I write on Facebook. But it's funny, when I started, before I got the job, I was finally, for the first time, I live in this town right here of Sleepy Hollow, where the Writers Center is. I've been here since 2009, and I was always so grateful to live in a place that had a Writers Center, and yet I rarely set foot in the thing, because I had smaller kids, I was a reporter, I had various jobs, and I just never got there, or just wasn't a good fit timing, or for whatever reason. And I finally thought I was in a good place where I was like, I'm going to write this bar novel now, and I'm going to take this class. And it happened that the director before me was an old friend of mine who used to run the Writers Center at the West Side Y in the city. And I was the first person he ever booked to read at his own reading series at the West Side Y. So since he was in the building, I was like, well, I should go, and it's finally time for me to take a class. And he recommended a great teacher, Kirsten Bacchus. And I was finally around the table with really great writers, getting really great feedback, and beginning in earnest this chunk of the book I wrote some years ago. And then I got the job. And I was like, I I couldn't really, you know, follow through on it. It was halfway through the summer and I kind of moved into the office. But I'm the managing director and I do a lot. It's very satisfying because I really enjoy doing a lot of different things. And I work in collaboration with Jennifer Franklin, who's the program director. So she determines events and workshops and everything on the calendar. And I'm in the office kind of more behind the scenes, but also the development person, doing a lot of the marketing, renting the place. I don't know if people know that they could have their private parties there, which is really fun. And just all the finances and all the miscellaneous details. I even built the website. So there's just a lot of a small nonprofit that people think, oh, well, it must be so idyllic. You're on the river in a little train station. Yes, but, you know, unfortunately, it's 99% on my computer and I'm in spreadsheets and I'm answering emails. So that makes me sad sometimes about the nature of work these days is so much on the computer, and that's how I spend a lot of my free time. So sometimes that's another reason why it's hard for me to write at the end of the day, because it would be more on my computer because I'm not really handwriting a novel. Sometimes I just don't want to look at the thing anymore.
You mentioned the program that Jennifer pushed together.
Yeah.
Could you tell the audience about some of the terrific programs at the center?
Yeah, so we have workshops year-round. We have basically two different kinds of workshops. You could either come in quick for a one-day, we call it an intensive, which is usually a four-hour block of time on a Saturday or a Sunday to get in and do something more focused in whatever genre. Or we have usually 6-week series, and a lot of them will meet weekly for 6 years, but then continue for another session, and they'll continue all year long. So people come and go, or they hunker down and stay with the teacher indefinitely while they're working on longer projects. And we have a lot of poetry classes, fiction. Memoir is extremely popular. Everybody wants to write a memoir. We have one teacher, we call her Sold Out Susan. She used to do 2 classes a week when I started, and now we quickly fill up 3, sometimes 4. So it's really says something about her, but also everybody's interest in memoir, I think. And then we have our classes all the time, and I think of the building as a bit of a one-room schoolhouse because it's pretty small but grand. We are in the old train station, and we've been there for 23 years in this historic building that you mentioned, Margo Stever. Margo and her husband Don kind of saved the station back in the day in the 1980s. It had been abandoned by Metro North, and it was just kind of left there to rot, and they had to produce a lot of money and grants and sponsors to do this huge campaign to save the station and renovate it enough to make it fit for the public to come in. It had holes in its roofs and raccoons living there and everything. So they started then with a great program of all kinds of readings and events and workshops, and that's continued. So when we don't have workshops, we have big and small authors from all over the place coming to read here. So we have emerging and established, and we have maybe at least a couple readings a month, if not more. Of course, we have our open mic, where I know you're always number one. And I'm pleased to say we're trying to do more things in the vein of open mic for more of the community creation aspect that I think writers need so much, because our work is very solitary, but we really want to come together and get feedback. So there's a newish thing, it's about a year old, that's called Open Write, where once a month on a Saturday night, people gather around the table with an informal host who will give them writing prompts, and they write a little bit and then they share, and there's wine and snacks. So I'm glad to have more of those informal things wherever they fit, because our audience is all over the map, and they literally come from all over the tri-state area. Some people are driving very far, and they have lots of a full range of expertise and across all genres. So I really want to provide something for everybody whenever it's possible in this one little room. So we do our best. Another cool new thing that's coming up is our first Shelf Saturday is happening, and that's on July 27th, and that's our first reading series that will feature self-published and or local people. So we'll have three self-published people in July, and we'll do that a couple times a year.
Good. Yeah, I've done some publishing. Do also have teachers that come from all over the place. I know that Amy Holman still is in Brooklyn, and she comes up there to teach. So they've got teachers.
Yeah, we have quite a few Brooklyn people. Yeah.
Yeah. I know that you have also taught creative writing. Is that at the center?
I haven't. That was another thing I always wanted to do, and I had it in the back of my mind to propose this and that, and I just didn't quite get there yet. But I taught at NYU, and before that I taught at Gotham, and through both of those I developed a lot of private clients as well, because eventually sometimes people approach you about working offline because they have this book that will never quit. So they wanted more intensive feedback alone. So it was nice that Gotham didn't mind handing them off to me for private stuff. And at NYU, I was at continuing studies doing stuff like writing 101. So it was a lot of beginner level people or some foreign students, people with different backgrounds, professional people who just, a lot of them, I feel like the starting point was that they were all really intimidated with writing. And it was really cool to work with that group and just encourage them to relax, basically. So that's been my approach in a lot of these forums, is to tell everybody to calm down and not try to teach them rules or anything, but just to get them writing and make them feel comfortable.
That's interesting. My first teaching job was NYU, and it was in technology, not in writing, because someone asked us to teach there because they knew of our background. But that took us to New School and to Marist and to SUNY Purchase and all these other places, just by having to be walk into at NYU. You've also been involved with other local activities, as I mentioned, and please tell us about them, like Runaway Art.
Yeah, so I've been very active in this community of Sleepy Hollow, as I couldn't be more tickled to live here in such a place. I didn't know Sleepy Hollow existed until one day I was driving home from, I was driving from Beacon to the city where I lived, because I got married in Beacon, and we were driving along Route 9, and we passed the cemetery, and there was a fog rising up, literally, and the misty sign that said, "Welcome to Sleepy Hollow," and I just couldn't believe it, and I went home and found a house immediately, and we made a bid on a house, like, that week. But I've been very engaged here. It's an incredible community that's all really involved and civic-minded, and great spirit of volunteerism. One of the big things we did lately that involved the Writer Center was the Sleepy Hollow Lit Fest, which the vision of it was that it's not just in one place, it was across the villages of Tarrytown and Sleepy Hollow in 8 different venues. So that felt like a big, messy undertaking, and I'm amazed it went as well as it did, and we feel so good about it. We'll do it every year. Before that, you mentioned Runaway Art. That was actually through a job I had. Before I worked at the Writers' Center, I was a consultant for 3 years with Historic Hudson Valley, which is more of a conglomeration of 5 different historic sites. One of them is right here in Sleepy Hollow, and then there's Van Cortlandt Manor in Croton that runs Blaze during the Halloween season. So you have these really interesting sites that are very historical, and they do these great tours, but then they're not afraid to become something very exciting after hours or on holidays. And so this nonprofit has made itself very successful by honoring the history, but making it very exciting and relatable to people and accessible. So a big program they had that I was the project manager for was called Runaway Art. We actually have a plantation in Sleepy Hollow, Phillipsburg Manor, that they operate, that in the 1800s was the, owned by the Phillips family, and it was operated by slaves. So people don't either want to think about that, or they don't know that we had slaves in colonial New York that helped us make our fortune here. And this family, this man basically, who was one of the wealthiest men in New York City at the time, owned all these vast swatches of land all the way up the Hudson, and they were run by slaves. So he had this farm here where they made the buildings. They even constructed the famous Old Dutch Church. And this program that I ran called Runaway Art was teaching that history of Northern colonial slavery to middle and high school kids in the inner city, in neighborhoods probably where they were more minority-based and underserved by the arts. So we brought them this history, but it was through an art program, because they would read the, there were actually runaway slave ads printed in local newspapers in colonial times that would describe the slave that ran away and can you help catch them for this reward. So the kids would read these ads, and then they would try to make an artistic portrait to enliven this person and give them a name if they didn't have a name in the ad, and give them characteristics and an identity, and just kind of take ownership of that story and remember how there's a person there that we're talking about. So it was really a satisfying program to be a part of, and I was very proud of it. And it was the biggest grant Historic Hudson Valley ever got. So I did that for 3 years, and then I happened to get this job when it was burning down.
That's very interesting. The family, that must have been all over the Hudson Valley, because the mansion fairly near where I lived was the Van Cortlandt family. They have a big mansion in Van Cortlandt Park, then they had something all the way up the Hudson, just kept going. There was Cortlandt this and Cortlandt that all over.
This isn't Van Cortlandt. This is a different family. This is a Philippe's family here.
Okay.
That owned Phillipsburg Manor, and we're in the Phillips Manor train station at the Writers Center. So his name is all over this particular neighborhood. But he stretched, and his wealth went all the way up to what is that thing called with the nose up there? Something anyway, further up the Hudson, his wealth kind of extended this wide swath of however many acres.
You also did something called Sleepy Hollow Shorts. What was that?
So that's a fun thing I'm reactivating this year, actually, and it'll be kind of through the Writer Center. So I try to take some of my old hobbies and incorporate them into my work, because it all fits together very well anyway. I'm just a creative person in different areas. So I guess in my older age, why am I not writing novels? One of the reasons is because I've become interested in other forms of storytelling, maybe a little more, that are easier for me to deal with in my current circumstances of not being able to have the time to write a novel. But Sleepy Hollow Shorts was 5 years ago I started, and I wanted to do this 30-second film festival, where the whole festival isn't 30 seconds, but each film would be. And the idea was just very informal, whatever kind of videos you want to make, even from your phone, and they have to be filmed in Sleepy Hollow. And they have to be 30 seconds or under. And then people can just submit their little videos that they make here that are under 30 seconds. They could submit it to my website, which is still there, and we still take submissions, which is sleepyhollowshorts.tumblr.com. And then I kind of curated this little festival that coincided that year with Oktoberfest in Kingsland Point Park in Sleepy Hollow, which is just this beautiful, fun community event that more people are coming to all the time because, you know, our season here of Halloween really extends now. We kind of launch it early September and it goes through November now. So we really like celebrate the fall season here. But that I'll do it again this year and we'll show whatever submissions we get, hopefully at the Wicked Words open mic, which is the third Friday in October. And we'll intersperse readings or whatever other people are doing with some short films. Hopefully. I don't know. It's been kind of quiet. I have to promote it more. So I'm glad to mention it now.
Yeah, I was involved in the first of the Wicked readings for Halloween. You were also involved with something called the Hudson Independent. What is that?
So that's our local newspaper. I'm happy to still have a newspaper. It extends, I mean, we have a couple newspapers, but their regions intersect a little bit and overlap on Sleepy Hollow. But the Hudson Independent covers a few of the river towns right here. And I wrote for them more actively before I started working at the Writers Center, but I've kept them kind of involved in our present life because I submit to them student submissions, like when teachers at the Writers Center share with me student work that they like, I try to send it over and get it published sometimes in the paper. But I have a long relationship with them as a reporter, but I was also recording oral histories with different groups in conjunction with the paper and the library. So we would meet with a group around a topic and I would record it and then I would put it up on SoundCloud and then I would write an accompanying article about it in the Hudson Independent with photos of the people we interviewed. And it was always really neat topics, like, you know, people with real ghost stories of Sleepy Hollow or what was it like here during World War II on the home front. Or, of course, you have to talk to GM workers. If you live in Sleepy Hollow, we have a big GM plant that made all the cars, and everybody works for that giant plant that's now just a brownfield that they're developing. So really good topics that you could still find on SoundCloud if you search for Warner Oral Histories for Warner Library.
That whole thing with the auto plants, there was a GM plant in Yonkers, and when it closed, there was a big deal made of how many workers at the plant had lost their jobs. What no one focused
yeah.
on were the local delis and the gas stations that were there, that all of a sudden they weren't selling lunches anymore, or there weren't people buying gas there. So there was a whole, not only the thing itself, but there were so many satellite things in Yonkers dependent on it. I don't think the Tarrytown had that quite that much dependence because it was so spread out, but everything around the GM plant in Yonkers, maybe Tarrytown, did have the same problems. I don't know.
We did. I think Sleepy Hollow, because we're very different. Tarrytown is adjacent to us, but Sleepy Hollow in and of itself it can be pretty run down and hasn't gentrified the way Tarrytown has. And our main strip here, which is called Beekman, is our main avenue, leads right to the GM plant. And back in the day, it used to have so many thriving businesses, and it's really hurt ever since. It's been a real, it's been very impactful, and people still really talk about this, that everything shut down. So I think we're still feeling it for sure. And this new development, you know, we have a lot of hope that it'll change everything, but that's scary too, because you don't actually want it to change everything exactly. Because there are new things coming up slowly, so if given time, I think good things are coming. But it's going to be very dramatic almost overnight that suddenly we're going to have 3,000 more people living here in this very small community. So it's coming.
And you also wrote an introduction for a new edition of Washington Irving's stories. How did you happen to get involved with that?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned. I almost forgot that. So I write more than I give myself credit for, because all the way along I'm a reporter, and I guess I've become known as a good person to ask in this town about the history here, and because I've worked at Historic Hudson Valley and been very engaged in all these different projects, somebody who knew me here, who happens to be an editor, approached me about would I like to write the intro for the 200-year collection called The Sketchbook by Washington Irving, which contains The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, which is, you know, we live and die by this story. It put us on the map. So we celebrate it here very much. But the villages right now happen to be celebrating the 200th anniversary, and we're having an 18-month bicentennial that the Lit Fest kind of began, and then there'll be all kinds of festivals in different genres for the next 18 months. But the timing of this book was a couple of years ago. I was asked to write the intro, and now I'm kind of peddling it a little bit more because it's so well-timed. But I was intimidated because there's so many people here who claim to be the village historian or this person who's an expert on his life. But I wrote it more from the standpoint of living it and living in this community, and how Irving's impacting us so much to this day at so many levels.
It was really
fun.
Yeah, it was published in 2015, and apparently it's still selling well on Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You mention your two daughters who are sitting with you at the center. How old are they, and what level of school are they presently in?
So I've got two girls, and they're 8 and 10, and I just want them to stop. I feel like that's enough. they're at a really good age. I used to be in a hurry for them to get to whatever next phase, because I found the current phase hard. But now I really like where they're at, and they're so creative, and they're smart, and they get along with each other, and they can kind of do their own thing. But they're young enough that they still love me and depend on me, but they're also independent. So it's just a really sweet spot. And the older one is about to go into the sixth grade, and I just find that terrifying. So I don't want to make them into Peter Pan or anything, but I'm like, that's enough. You're good. Stop growing.
That's great.
Yeah.
What's next for you?
Gosh, I do want to write this book. So I hope I can find, I really want to succeed at the Writer Center and succeed enough that I can achieve some balance there, where I don't feel like it's always so frantic for me, because I work a lot, I work too much. I would like to settle into that a little more after 2 years. I feel like it's time to find a pattern and stick with it. But I would like to find balance where I can revert to being more of a writer in my own time. And I do have that book about the bar that I want to write. I have to fictionalize my 5 years in a bar.
We've touched a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like our audience to know about you?
I think we really covered it. Follow your bliss. No, I can't say I've exactly followed my bliss, but it's given me great joy and comfort to always have this writer thing I carry around. And whether or not I'm actually writing or producing books, like, I'm still always a writer. So I think I've relaxed a little bit about what that looks like and how much I have to produce. I'm just a writer kind of in my mentality and how I see things. So I think that's important to take that pressure off whoever is listening. We have our teacher here at the Writer Center, Kirsten Bacchus, teaches a class called I'm Not a Real Writer. And she puts the not in parentheses, because who's a real writer? Like, everybody has doubts and insecurities, and maybe you're at an impasse where you're not writing at all, but you could still be a writer.
Well, that's good, and thank you very much. Terrific tonight.
Thank you. It was really fun.
The let me get back here. Chris's books, including the Irving connection, collection are available on Amazon. And for look at all the programs offered by the wonderful, I've said it again, Hudson Valley Writers Center, go to writerscenter.org. That's Writer Center, one word, WriterScenter.org. Send any comments or questions to me about this show to johnmack13@gmail.com, and be sure to join us the next week at the same time. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, and unfortunately there haven't been too many of them, I'll put it in the book. And until next time, as the son of the old neighbor, see ya. But go off with the Eagles again. Alexa, Amazon, play Take It Easy by the Eagles, please.
What do you want me to play?
Taking It Easy.
Playing Take It Easy from your library on Amazon Music.
Thank you again, Kristen. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.